The famous Golden World Cup trophy was unveiled during a ceremony at a mall in Doha, where excited football fans waited for their turn to see it. They were also given the option to take a selfie or have their photo taken professionally. While the competition is still nearly a year away, FIFA says more than a million tickets were requested within the first 24 hours after sales opened. The highest demand came from fans from Qatar, followed by Argentina, Mexico and United States, among others. Bangladesh is reviving the ancient tradition of producing a historically renowned fine hand-woven fabric called muslin. With the help of the government, the trade is making a comeback. Now, a workshop has been set up in Dhaka where weavers are being trained in the ancient art. They say it took them months to master the craft, working with incredibly fine hand-spun cotton yarns. The weavers say it takes them 8 hours to spin just 4 centimeters. Some varieties of the fabric are so fine that an entire muslin sari could fit inside a single matchbox.
There was a myth about muslin that it was so delicate that it would pass through even a small ring. Look, it's true. There is space to squeeze in another piece of cloth through this ring as well.
Breathing life back into this ancient trade was not easy. Officials with a revival project say there was little knowledge about how this fabric was made. Plus, the rare cotton variant, which makes this fabric so expensive, was also lost. The precious fabric was the most extravagant of its era and popular in Mughal courts. It was also imported into Europe for much of the 17th century and transformed the style of the aristocracy there.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
The mass massacre in a single day of 81 blindfolded, mostly Shia Muslims by Riyadh, have exposed as dastardly hypocrites the political figures and even governments of many regional countries who chose to ignore this sanguine crime against humanity. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan, international staff writer. This article is published under the heading Recent Events That Fully Exposed the Hypocrites. Stay tuned for more. The mass massacre in a single day of 81 blindfolded mostly Shia Muslims by Riyadh have exposed as dastardly hypocrites the political figures and even governments of many regional countries who chose to ignore this sanguine crime against humanity. Now, no amount of pretensions to patriotism or supposed sovereignty of their native lands will ever wash this strain from the faces of these diabolical figures for not just failure to denounce the Al Saud clan, but also to question the timely action of the Islamic Republic of Iran in salvaging the security and dignity of Iraq and its Muslim people by demolishing of Israeli regime spying centers in Erbil, Iraqi Kurdistan. It is rather strange of these so-called Muslims to be complicit in crimes against fellow Muslims because the cult ruling Arabia is awash with the stolen oil wealth of the deprived people of the eastern region, and the illegal Zionist entity, which is in usurpation of Palestine, happens to be the blue-eyed boy of the great Satan. Does this mean the politicians and regimes of Muslim countries are justified in turning a blind eye to the Najdi's slaughtering of Shia Muslims as an internal affair, along with the claim to be unaware of Zionist infiltration in Iraq and other lands as an external issue? Yet these very same people of feeble faith feel no inhibitions in raising a hue and cry over Iran's defense of the rights and Islamic aspirations of the Iraqi nation by blasting with precision missiles the Mossad center in Erbil, which was operating because of the camaraderie of some traitorous elements in the local administration and weaklings in the central government incapable of ensuring the country's integrity and sovereignty through lack of guts in telling the American occupiers to leave, despite the fact that the Iraqi parliament has passed a unanimous resolution in this regard. Thanks, however, to the patriotic masses of Iraq who have fully supported the decisive strike on the Israeli regime base in Erbil and have also decisively castigated the murderous regime of Riyadh for its bouts of massacres of the innocents, as well as Yemen's invasion, Iraq will neither become an American client state nor will it be a playground for Zionist plots in the region. As a fraternal and friendly neighbor, Iran fully supports the will of the Iraqi people. And this was the reason the Iranian ambassador in Baghdad held a press conference in the holy city of Karbala to explain the Islamic Republic's readiness to provide assistance against foreign designs. Iraj Masjidi did not mince words when he highlighted that the missile attack was carried out in order to safeguard security, and addressing Kurdish officials, he said, "We expect you to force Israelis out of Iraqi soil and get rid of them. If, however, they are not expelled, will we stand by with our hands tied behind us to allow them carry out operations against our security? Definitely not." The message from the Iraqi people is also loud, clear to the murderous regime in Riyadh. Your days are numbered. You will not be saved by the U.S., neither by the Zionists, nor by the hypocrisy of the so-called politicians who turn a blind eye to your terrorism and crimes against humanity.
Midstream.
We
With sarcasm, bitterness, and anger, social media activists launched a hashtag titled The Caliph of the Muslims after Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan received the Israeli President Isaac Herzog in Ankara. Many considered the warm reception of the Turkish president in Ankara a massive fall for the Muslim president, who has long chanted in support of Muslim causes in the East and the West. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who was presenting himself as the Caliph of Muslims who wanted to revive the Ottoman Caliphate and restore the glories, warmly embraced the Israeli guest and considered the visit a historic one. "This is a new page," Erdogan said, "in the relations between his country and a racist terrorist entity that occupies sanctities and works to obliterate its Islamic identity in Palestine." This visit came after a 13-year boycott following the massacre perpetrated by an Israeli commando unit against Turkish activists who were on board the Marmara Flotilla, which was on its way to break the siege on the Gaza Strip, leading to the death of 10 people. Today, millions of Arabs and Muslims are disappointed after they were deceived by President Erdogan. Their admiration peaked when he shouted at Shimon Peres in protest of his lies, saying at the Davos summit in 2009, "You are murderers and criminals who master the process of killing innocents well," then proceeded to collect his papers and withdraw from the meeting. Little did these Arabs and Muslims know at the time that he would later embrace Isaac Herzog, the son of a member of the terrorist Haganah gang and the head of an entity that practices terrorism and racism in its worst forms against a people Erdogan claims to support their cause. Many of us already saw that President Erdogan lost a lot of his credibility when he led the project to destroy neighboring Syria and send his forces to occupy a large part of its lands, along with Iraqi lands, and use the weak Syrian refugees as financial bargaining chip with the European Union, and then recruited large numbers of them as mercenaries to fight in Libya and Azerbaijan, and now in Ukraine to support the American-Israeli project there. I personally do not understand how millions really believe that President Erdogan would lead the Islamic world against normalization and the Zionist occupation entity when economic trade and military alliances with Israel not only remained as is, but rather increased over the past 10 years. He did play it well when he threatened to withdraw the Turkish ambassador from Abu Dhabi in protest of the so-called Abraham's Peace Accord and the UAE's reception of President Herzog. But now, since he laid down the red carpet for Herzog, hugged him affectionately, and promised new and improved relations with Zionist Israel, only fools will believe his support for a free and democratic Palestine. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan received the president of the Israeli enemy Isaac Herzog in his palace last week with a robust and warm reception after what looked like a political estrangement since 2008. Various contexts and attempts have been made to heal the rift in the relationship between the two sides. Although the push towards reforming the relationship was an Israeli one during the past 15 years, however, the recent Turkish keenness to normalize relations with the enemy and restore the impurities of the previous stage was predominant. What are the motives of the Turkish leadership to normalize relations with the Israeli entity at all levels? To discuss this issue with us from the West Bank is Mr. Saleh Abu Azzi, writer and political commentator from Jenin. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Saleh Abu Azzi. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who was presenting himself as the Caliph of Muslims who wanted to revive the Ottoman Caliphate and to restore its glories, he embraced the Israeli guest and considered his visit a historic one. And he was hoping for a new page to be open in the relationship between his country and a very racist terrorist entity occupying sanctities and ethnically cleansing Palestinians since 1948. Why was that even a surprise to the Muslims across the world when trade and security ties never stopped between Israel and Turkey?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, at-tahiyya lakum wa liqanatikum al-kareema.
Greetings to you and your kind followers. Undoubtedly, just as there is a huge media machine led by imperialism and global Zionism, there is also a media empire led by the Qatari Turkish Axis. This media empire worked hard to brighten the image of Turkish President Erdogan and to portray him in the Arab and Islamic world, especially in the Arab world, as the protector of Islamic causes, especially the Palestinian cause. This depiction has been going on for more than 20 years. That is, as soon as the Turkish president came to power at the beginning of the second millennium until this moment. All throughout, this media machine worked hard to brighten his image according to populist slogans, in addition to great support from the activist, cultural, intellectual, and religious scholars' movement. We know that this group has real strength in the Arab and Islamic street. This made Erdogan a symbol and icon in accordance with the Brotherhood's promotion campaign and the Turkish-Qatari one. This resulted in an obvious contradiction at more than one stage of Erdogan's rule in Turkey. First, when he withdrew the ambassadors after the Marmara Flotilla massacre in 2010, and now with this latest visit by Herzog took place. This was reflected within the narrative led by the Turkish-Qatari Brotherhood media. We saw two contradictory narratives.
Well, Mr. Saleh, what you're saying is very, very important, but despite the ongoing trade and military ties that is going on between the two sides, we did hear the Turkish president express his desire now to cooperate with Israel in the framework of a project to extend a gas pipeline in the eastern Mediterranean so that it supplies from what he refers to as Israel directly to Europe through Turkish territory. Now, Israel had already signed the East Med pipeline with Cyprus and Greece. Would Israel be willing to risk this accord for signing another one with Turkey?
The issue of the Mediterranean gas is the most important regional issue in the Turkish-Israeli relationship, after which Erdogan tried to demarcate the maritime borders with Libya to block the agreement you referred to between Cyprus and Greece. There was even a presence of the Palestinian Authority, Jordan, and the UAE, with the Israeli entity along with Egypt within the Mediterranean Gas Forum. Now Turks and Erdogan have found themselves outside this equation on the one hand, and on the other hand, the United States is a major supporter of the Mediterranean Gas Forum led by Israel and Egypt. Therefore, Erdogan wanted to crowd out this forum by building bridges of relationship with the Israeli entity first. And because this is an important point for Turkey, that the stolen Palestinian gas from Palestinian lands and Palestinian waters be transported through Turkish lands toward Europe. But will Erdogan's effort succeed in this regard? I believe that Israelis who stated previously in January 2022 that Tel Aviv's relationship with Ankara will not in any way affect Israel's strategic and solid relationship with Cyprus and Greece. The power sponsoring this relationship is the United States of America. Erdogan realizes that the relationship with the Israeli entity is a key to Biden's approval. And the second point is that Erdogan also realizes that the gas project will not take place with exclusive Turkish-Israeli approval, as long as there is American sponsorship of this agreement, so that Cyprus and Greece do not suffer injustice from their share of the gas that is intended to go to Europe, which, by the way, is a stolen Palestinian gas.
Exactly,
Mr. Saleh, this is what I want to talk about, is that this is how the Turkish regime views it. But the Turkish people, or most of them for that case, they cannot accept for their country's government to become a broker for the stolen Palestinian gas. How do you think the Turkish public will reflect their will given this new Turkish-Israeli rapprochement?
Erdogan came to power with the votes of the Turkish people when he played the economic card. He will continue to play this card, especially as the Turkish lira continues to collapse against the U.S. dollar and the deterioration of the Turkish economy after the corona pandemic. Now, the story that Erdogan will present to the Turkish people is that he wants a strong economy for Turkey, and for Turkey to remain within the G20, especially since it fell in 2021 to be number 21 after it was ranked number 19 in terms of economic strength. On the other hand, the Turkish opposition deals with two narratives with the Turkish people. The first narrative supports the economy, and the other contradicts Erdogan's approach. The Turkish people realize that the bickering over the nature of Turkish-Israeli normalization is strictly between the regime and its opposition. I believe that the Turkish people completely reject normalization, and this is what appeared during and after Herzog's visit to Ankara, where demonstrations took place in Istanbul and other Turkish cities rejecting this normalization, because the Turkish people belong to the Islamic nation, its projects and concerns. But on the other hand, whether pro-Erdogan or opposing him, they both will work for the Turkish economic interest with Israel. So there will be no real change in the upcoming elections in Turkey, whether Erdogan wins or the opposition wins.
Definitely, we have to wait and see in 2023 what will happen with the internal elections inside of Turkey. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Saleh Abu Azze, writer, journalist, and political commentator from Jenin in the occupied West Bank, for joining us to discuss this issue. Now, please stay tuned, because what we will be talking about next is the 8th-year war on Yemen.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The dramatic Yemeni progress in the 8th year of the war tightened the noose around the kingdom's neck and changed its priorities from fighting against the entire axis of resistance in the areas of regional influence to withdrawing to the Saudi interior geography. The steadfastness of the Yemeni people led the kingdom to retreat from its previous challenges. However, retreating does not mean changing the goals, but rather changing the priorities for Riyadh, which seemingly has recoiled to preserve the security from within its own borders. The shift in the balance of power and the deterrence equations drawn by the 8th year of the war, the year of decisiveness, according to the Yemenis, enabled Sana'a to move from defense mode to a gradual, ascending, and unprecedented attack. More details in the following report.
The Saudi vision of getting out of the war in Yemen is inseparable from the mentality with which the campaign began 8 years ago in March 2015 with what was called Operation Decisive Storm. A mentality based on superiority and domination, far from the goals of wars and drawing clear applicable strategies, is still in force despite the track of 8 years of absurdity. The decision-makers in Al Yamama Palace in Riyadh have linked their fate to the outcome of the war, as they are on the cusp of a 9th year with no viable range of options for the initiators of war in sight. At this stage, the Saudi-led coalition of aggression has two options. The first, to continue the war. This means more attrition with no prospect of winning. This also means a direct threat to the Saudi and Emirati inner borders, which will have political, economic, and external repercussions on the regimes there. The second option is ending the war through a political settlement. This will also have major repercussions, because any settlement will be the product of failure and a deadlocked horizon politically and militarily. If this kind of settlement takes place, it would be the direct result of the victory of Sana'a, and therefore the latter will impose its conditions on the negotiating table. The most important of these conditions is the refusal to touch Yemen's national sovereignty. Hence, the previous equations presented to Ansarullah as having at least 5 or 4 components, which were completely rejected by Sana'a during the stages of steadfastness and defense, will obviously not be acceptable in the current stage of resistance and confrontation, dubbed by the Yemenis as the year of decisiveness and attack. What remains as a constant since the start of this war is that the power to immediately end the war on Yemen lies with Washington, which still sees in the continuation of the war its interest on more than one level, particularly in the field of arms sales to Saudi Arabia or in terms of weakening Yemen and keeping it away from the axis of resistance. However, Riyadh is stunned to oblivion with how things have developed in the eighth year of its genocidal war on the Yemeni people. After it was hoping for the imminent fall of Sana'a, it was forced, facing the gravity of the challenges, to beg for direct protection from Washington, which sent thousands of its soldiers and seemingly a failing Patriot air defense systems in exchange for billions of dollars paid in advance. Sana'a's success in maintaining the unity of the ranks, the most prominent of which was its prior success in preventing the forces of aggression from penetrating its internal fronts. Perhaps one of the most prominent features of the response stage is the technical development in the areas of ballistic missile production and bomber drones, as well as the accumulation of military experiences. With this transition, Sana'a succeeded in drawing a line between the strategy of years of confrontation, steadfastness, and strategic patience to move into the final year of decisiveness.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Yemeni activist and media persona Musa Ali Ad-Darwani. Thank you very much for being with us, Ms. Ali. Now, in the war waged by Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates on Yemen, the challenge to Sana'a has turned into a serious threat to both Riyadh and Abu Dhabi and the rest of the cities. With time, this threat grows even darker and deadlier for both capitals. Now, Riyadh, under the current objective conditions, is no longer able to dictate its own terms inside of Yemen. How do you assess this shift in power on the eighth anniversary of the brutal Saudi-led war on the Yemeni people?
I would like to thank you for having me on your show and thank your followers. During 8 years, there have been great changes and transformations that were not imagined by Riyadh. Riyadh entered its war thinking that it would resolve it within a few days or weeks. The International Resolution 2216 came less than a month after the start of the aggression against Yemen, and it called for opening the doors of dialogue in Riyadh under the umbrella of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, or under Saudi sponsorship of all Yemeni parties. They thought that their war would bring the Yemeni parties to their door. If not on their own, then at least force them to negotiate under Saudi auspices and in the way Saudi Arabia wants. Today, we are talking about 8 years. The moment has shifted between the beginning of the aggression and today. There are very significant changes in Yemen's armed capabilities. Saudi Arabia announced from the beginning that it wanted to end what it called the dangers it's facing in Yemen. Yet we see, on the contrary, that there were no dangers coming from Yemen at all. Yemen, by its nature, does not represent a danger to any of the neighboring countries, but the faulty Saudi view is what made them think that. Today there is a great danger against Saudi Arabia, and this danger is not only from Yemen. The danger is from Saudi way of thought of continuing the aggression against Yemen. If Saudi Arabia continues its aggression, the Yemeni military capabilities that are escalating will certainly strike wherever they can reach. At the beginning of the war, the Yemenis did not have ballistic missiles with a range more than 1,000 kilometers. Today, we are talking about missiles with a range of 1,200 and 1,500 kilometers. These capabilities did not exist. But today, these missiles are striking deep inside Riyadh and beyond. Also, the bomber drones, from the Rasad to Qasif to Samad 1, 2, and 3. Today, there are still two types of bomber drones that have not been used yet, and that were revealed by the military media earlier. So, the dangers that Saudi Arabia was talking about was an illusion. Yet today, it has become a reality. And the Yemeni force, which Riyadh tried to destroy, today has multiplied more. And Saudi Arabia will find itself unable to confront even the thought of facing a military force that has become like this. let alone confronting this force in the field.
What you are mentioning is very, very important, specifically the technical development in the areas of missile, ballistic missiles and bomber drones, as well as the accumulation of military experiences, have put Sana'a's hand on the upper side of this war. But do you think this will be enough to put an end to the Saudi-led coalition of aggression's absurd war and siege on Yemen?
Perhaps until now, the enemy is still stagnant and thinks that these capabilities may be all the Yemenis possess, and therefore they continue with their arrogant way in the aggression and siege. The Saudis think that by using the blockade, they can weaken or contribute to the weakening of the Yemeni people. However, the truth is that even before the aggression, Yemenis were not luxurious. To fear the collapse of the state of luxury they were living in, Yemenis are accustomed to the hardship of living and to the interruption of services. The previous regimes that ruled Yemen were completely controlled by Saudi Arabia. In order to keep Yemen weak, have poor services, and remain without security or stability, so that Yemen would remain submissive and not pose a threat to neighboring countries. Today, this Saudi stubbornness is still going on. But if they want to continue with this arrogance against the Yemeni people, the future will certainly be more dangerous. What happened in the past 2 days, the operation to break the siege by 9 drones, which led to a fire in one of Aramco's refineries in Riyadh. Perhaps this was one of the renewed messages. Previously, there were operations such as Abqaiq and Khurais operation, which halted half of Saudi oil production, and these operations may be repeated. Of course, unfortunately, there are no signs that Saudi Arabia is willing to back down from the aggression course against the Yemeni people. But with this path, it will not reach any result. Saudi Arabia saw that during 8 years, the curves of Yemeni military capabilities went upward, while Saudi Arabia has used up all its cards. From the first moment, it imposed aggression, killing and massacres, but it did not accomplish anything.
Definitely, but the military steadfastness, Musali, and the power that you are talking about are very important to maintain leverage in Yemen against the coalition of aggression. Yet the aerial, the sea, and the land blockade has devastated the Yemeni economy. And lately, fuel shortages have reached unprecedented levels, causing some hospitals to completely shut down in Yemen, while millions of Yemenis are in dire need for aid, food, and medicine. What do you think will it take to break the siege, knowing that the hypocrisy of the international community has reached unprecedented levels in selective attention and in selective support?
It's true, as you said, with regard to the United Nations. For the Yemenis, the international community is no longer neutral or silent. Rather, it became a participant and an accomplice. It became part of the aggression against Yemen. The international resolutions that we have witnessed since the beginning of the aggression until today, it all puts the international community, and the Security Council in particular, led by the United States of America and Western powers, at the forefront of the aggressors against our people. The loss that is being imposed on Yemen today comes under the title of implementing international resolutions, while the United Nations stands helpless. We see that the naval ships, fuel and food, are being piped and towed to Jizan port and prevented from reaching the port of Hodeidah. It's being hacked by the forces of aggression. After Yemen obtains the necessary permits from the United Nations in accordance with international resolutions. However, the international community remains silent, despite reports describing the Yemeni tragedy as the world's largest human tragedy. What happened in the selective and discretionary positions of the United Nations, the Security Council in particular, and the Human Rights Council, is telling the Yemenis that you must pluck your thorns with your own hands. The message that arrived from the international community was clearly understood by the Yemeni people from the first moments of the aggression, and they began to intensify their production efforts. There are many areas in which Yemenis excel despite the siege and aggression. For example, agricultural field. There is a large campaign at the internal level to obtain wheat cultivation and reach self-sufficiency. True, we are still far away, but the journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. This step has already begun. There is no bet on the international community yet. The bet is on the Yemenis themselves, and God Almighty is the conciliator and the aid.
For sure, and on the 8th anniversary of this brutal war, we wish nothing but peace and sovereignty for all Yemenis. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Ali Darwani, Yemeni activist and media persona, joining us from Beirut to talk about this crucial matter right here and now. Thank you very much for being with us. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East stream. Have a nice week.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
The Limelight.
Children seem to be facing increasing risks as mask mandates are abandoned and vaccination rates stall, says Melanie Schreiber, reporter, in an article published under the heading, "One-third of all U.S. child COVID deaths occurred during Omicron surge." Stay tuned for more. As many as a third of all child deaths from COVID in the United States have occurred during the Omicron surge of the pandemic. Children seem to be facing increasing risks from COVID-19 even as mask mandates drop across the country and vaccination rates among children stall out at alarmingly low rates. We saw a massive surge of hospitalized young children during Omicron that we didn't see in the earlier months of the pandemic, said Jason Kane, a pediatric intensivist and associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Chicago Comer Children's Hospital. Since the beginning of the year, 550 children have died from COVID-19 in the U.S., compared with 1,070 children in the preceding 22 months, according to data from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. The figures cover the group aged 0 to 17. Their fatality rate remains the lowest compared to other cohorts. Omicron was first identified in November and within weeks became the dominant variant in the US. Although Omicron is less severe than Delta, it is 3 to 5 times more deadly in the overall population than pre-Delta variants were. Recent CDC research shows the variant may also affect younger children in different ways than previous versions of the virus. Omicron tends to infect the upper airways, which in children are narrower and can be more easily irritated. Kane said, "Omicron really did something different than Delta, and I don't think it was just because more kids were infected." He saw younger patients with illnesses similar to croup and bronchiolitis, which can be dangerous in young children with a pediatric airway the diameter of a pencil, he said. "It's no longer fair even to insinuate that COVID doesn't affect children. That COVID deaths are only in unhealthy children or kids with risk factors. That's just not true by the data." The under 5 age group saw record high hospitalizations over the past few months. Omicron hospitalization rates for kids under the age of 5 soared 5 times higher at Omicron's peak than during the Delta wave, according to recent CDC research. Among all ages of children, those under 1 may face the highest risk of severe disease, yet they're not able to take many of the precautions available to older people. Children under 2 cannot wear face masks, and children under 5 are not yet eligible for COVID vaccination. Nearly 5 million children have been infected with COVID in 2022, and cases are now sharply declining. The majority of children who become infected with COVID have mild cases, and they are the population with the lowest death rate. That may change as variants evolve and emerge. Kane called it the million-dollar question. "Omicron has been very bad for kids. We don't know what future variants will do," said Julia Rafman, assistant professor at the Boston University School of Public Health, who flagged the sharp uptick in Omicron deaths, adding, "We don't have a good enough understanding of what protection there is from prior infection, how long it lasts, how robust it is." In the coming months, Rafe Mann said, "We will see a lot more infection, and more cases will always mean more hospitalizations and deaths, especially with low vaccination rates." Florida Surgeon General recently recommended against vaccinating healthy kids given the possibility of side effects, which remain extremely rare and are outweighed by vaccines protection. "Vaccines are highly effective against severe illness, hospitalization, and death for eligible children, but less than 30% of children between the ages of 5 and 11 are vaccinated in the U.S., and a little more than half of children between 12 to 17 are vaccinated. Preventive measures like masks should stay in place at schools and daycares, as well as parents' workplaces and public transportation, in order to protect children as long as the virus is circulating," Rafman said. She added, "The kids who are too young to wear masks really need other people to reduce transmission around them." Requiring face masks in schools during the Delta wave last fall helped reduce COVID cases by 23%. According to CDC research published recently. "A nationwide child vaccination campaign is very important as well," Rafman said, "especially one in multiple languages that focuses on low-income communities where not enough families have gotten vaccinated." COVID has hit marginalized communities harder, and vaccination rates and access to medical care tend to be lower in the same communities, creating a double whammy, Kane said. Vaccines provide some protection against infection, which helps keep the virus from spreading, and they also offer excellent protection against hospitalization and death. Vaccinating and boosting those who are eligible would help protect children too young to be eligible themselves, as well as providing other important benefits, Rafman said. We have never achieved high enough vaccinations in the United States. We lag far behind other countries, and it makes us really vulnerable to continued high rates of death, hospitalization, social disruption, and economic disruption. And deaths are only one measure of COVID's effects, she said. Long COVID is also a concern for kids. The record high hospitalizations are concerning for kids. Amid the fear and exhaustion of the Omicron surge, Kane's overwhelming feeling was frustration because proven measures are available to keep many children from becoming severely ill or dying. He said, "Kids shouldn't die. Kids shouldn't die."
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said, contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Iran allowed some 2,000 women into Tehran's Azadi Stadium to cheer their national football team as it beat Iraq 1-0. It was a game that secured Iran's entry into the 2022 Qatar World Cup. But it was women's entry to the stadium that made the headlines in January. The world seemed to think the earlier ban on women entering was to segregate men and women and that hijab meant no sports or public participation on the part of women. Well, here's what I found in an enormous Tehran park covering an area of 35 hectares. Nahjul Balagha Park is a small sample of Iran-Tehran's natural landscaping. Cut out in the hills, it has created a layered environment for mild climbing and privacy for groups wanting to exercise to their own choice music. Sports have hardly split and divided society, but rather have brought communities together by a common interest. Men and women of West Tehran have found a healthy haven here to keep fit in company. For more on women and men and sports and sporting, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. I got to talk to the two coaches and some of their trainees. Community sport, as it turns out, can be a formal open-air club with a professional coach. Let's begin with Mr. Adabi, who takes his work very seriously in keeping the city fit.
Before the Islamic Revolution, it was called the Swedish workout. After the victory of the Islamic Revolution, it came to be known as the morning workout. It all started at Lale Park in Tehran. The coaches were trained and sent to parks across the city. They are still mainly based in Lale Park. Any park you visit, there are 5-6 coaches working out with tens of people. There are variable timetables for the workouts too. Any hour in the day, there might be a workout scheduled. I personally go to Sattarkhan Park, where people exercise from 6 to 7 a.m. There are some 300 people there every morning, most of whom are women.
Participants in the Park Club, so to speak, say what the sessions do for them and whether their modest Islamic clothing is a hindrance.
It's not a problem at all, because I'm properly dressed and have no problem in my opinion. These days, women exercising is something quite accepted. This exercise is well established across all parks. In the past, women would stay at home, only eating and sleeping, but it's no longer like that. Due to their occupation and to maintain their health, they are compelled to work out.
Public sports are taken seriously in Iran, although Coach Ardabi believes authorities should show their seriousness more generously. By 2018, 600,000 women were enjoying the recreational facilities of Tehran municipality. That's cultural, training and sports facilities provided in Tehran's 22 districts.
I'm an official. I'm the head of public sports in Tehran province and also work at a position at the Public Sports Federation. I promise that if they support us, we can bring everyone to the parks. Our coaches are able to take people to the parks. We can organize various events. We can organize competitions and give away prizes to winners of tug-of-war, darts, rope skipping, or running races.
The idea was and is to focus on physical and psychological health of women as the pivots of families. Fatemeh Rakei was the then head of Women's Affairs Department of Tehran Municipality. Ms. Ardalan was captain to the women's futsal team. She's now chief coach to the Futsal National Omid Team, or the Hope National Team, which won the Asian Futsal Championship title under her coaching. Unfortunately, we just got to talk to her via Skype.
In fact, by working out and competing, you'll taste victory and defeat, which can help you in your personal life. When a lady knows the taste of defeat, she'll also know that with enough effort, she can achieve better results and higher goals. Experience shows that if that's extended to her life, the results will be quite positive. Our daughters can grow to become healthy mothers in society and raise healthy kids. I think the only way to protect women's sports is that our authorities support sports and federations take proper steps in that regard.
She said Shahrbanu complexes were working as women-only centers to create a safe and secure environment to meet the essential cultural, social, entertainment, and sports needs of women. The women I spoke to were perfectly happy with their natural Balagha haven. They tell of their dress code, or choice rather, as they don't sound a bit hampered.
It's not like that at all. You can wear comfortable and well-covering clothes here and exercise easily. I've been working out for 20 years. Thanks to my routine, I'm completely healthy. I'm quite satisfied with my workout and I'm always energetic and fresh. I'd been swimming for 20 years before the pandemic hit, but now, due to the COVID-19 outbreak, I'm swimming less frequently. But the park's always there and we're always at the park. Before they built this park, I used to come here to take a walk. Since they built this place, I've been working out and walking here.
Wearing a hijab isn't a limitation for us. We take part in international competitions, either in Asia or elsewhere. It does create its difficulties, though, in Eastern Asian countries. Because of the high level of humidity, the clothes can affect the athlete's performance. But I've always believed that the hijab hasn't caused any limitations for us. If anything, it's encouraged us to try even harder. It's as if all the other teams are one point ahead of us, especially in some sports. I was watching women's soccer yesterday and saw our team playing under heavy rain. They wear track pants, scarves, headbands, and other clothes that will get heavy and slow them down. But they try their hardest regardless.
It's some 5 years, musical aerobics for mixed groups have become a part of the natural scene. Our lady coach explained to me how the change came about because of hordes of women taking to community exercise and parks, and the system understanding it's a matter of, you could say, supply and demand. Our natural Balagha Park Club has more than one coach. To match the composition of trainees or members, there's a lady co-coach too to complement Mr. Ardabi. Like their trainees, they were balls of positive energy.
It's not a limitation at all. We observe hijab, but it doesn't create any limitations whatsoever. I'm training people outdoors. I don't see a limitation. We even do rehabilitation exercises on yoga mats. We can definitely benefit from working out in a more closed up space. But if people want to exercise, they definitely can do it.
But women, especially those engaging in more traditional covering, enjoy taking their hijab off altogether under the sun. And so women's parks were an idea. It's momentary segregation by choice. By 2019, a fifth women's park had opened in Tehran, the capital city, named after Marzia Hadidchi. The idea was to bring about justice and equality for all citizens, as it would allow muhajaba women the freedom to wear less, like men, without the discomfort of feeling prying eyes on them. This would help eradicate vitamin D deficiency Muslim women suffer also, ironically so, in super sunny West Asia. The first women-only park opened up in the capital in 2008 by the name Beheshta Madaron, or Mother's Paradise. Muhajaba means a woman wearing hijab or Islamic covering as a religious obligation. Talking of hijab, here's a typically Iranian paradox. In some walks of life, hijab has actually promoted women's participation in sports. That's mostly among the more traditional families who wouldn't want their daughters jumping up and down in gym suits with male counterparts. Knowing there are women-only sports clubs and parks has allowed free access to their girls. Participation in professional international tournaments may be a problem for Iranian women having to wear hijab by mandate, but there's a whole range of sports they can participate in with flesh covered if international sports federations and bodies set aside their paranoid focus on dress. Banning muhajaba women from participating would appear to stem from their prejudice or fear against Islamic dress and teaching rather than a care for women's rights anyway. Ms. Izadi, paraglider, rock climber and martial artist, is a national champion who can also handle weapons and disarm an opponent.
When an athlete wants to compete and aims at winning the prize, the hijab won't be an issue for her. She won't even think of whether the hijab would be a hurdle. I personally haven't thought like this. Maybe in other sports, including those in which the organizing country might prevent you from participating because of your hijab, like in swimming or similar sports, the situation might be different, but we've been raised wearing hijab. The other point to mention is that there is an endless variety for wearing hijab at this point. We have so many different options to wear. We can choose perfectly comfortable sportswear.
Talking of professional sports, let's take a look at some female Iranian medalists or pioneers. Iran held India in AFC, the Asian Football Federation's Women's Asian Cup, January 2022. As reported, it was after Maryam Irandu's girls defeated Jordan 4-2 on penalties after a goalless draw that they booked their place in India, where Iran's goalkeeper Zohra Kudai was chosen the best player of the match.
Iranian's goal is to raise the Islamic Republic's flag. It doesn't matter if the athlete is male or female. The important thing is to compete and raise the flag and hear the national anthem playing in the end in the country. This is a proud moment we all would love to experience. All these issues led to our colleagues coming together and supporting women's sports and taking it more seriously. We're now seeing that women are increasingly securing titles in Asia, the Olympics, or other competitions around the world in group and individual sports. I hope this trend continues and the support goes on. I have every confidence that Iranian women can shine in every sport out there around the world.
Like I said, indoor sports have encouraged many muhajaba women or otherwise as they can practice hours in lighter clothes. The Guardian of July 3, 2021 ran a catchy headline, Shahrzad Mozaffar, Iran's female futsal trailblazer who defied the odds. The story of how a sport-crazy girl led her country to futsal glory and became a role model. The girl who had been looking for a ball her whole life, as she put it, led the nation's futsal team to a second Asian Football Confederation women's title in 2018.
تمایل خانم ها به ورزش خیلی زیادتر شده.
Women are more willing to work out these days. There is a sort of competition between them. There are several reasons why they want to exercise. As the head of a sports complex, I've seen ladies coming here to lose weight so they could feel confident in their personal lives or at their workplace or anywhere else. It boosts their self-confidence. That's why they're a lot more willing to work out. It helps them with their self-confidence and mental health. This contributes to better public health. Women like to be champions and live in an environment where they can grow. When they see other women achieving their goals, they are motivated to attain their own goals too and regret what they haven't achieved. It'll serve society if we take the necessary steps to encourage women to become champions.
By 2005, for Muzaffar came